Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build and maintain gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring the culture to horticulture.
It does bring the culture to horticulture.
Yeah. It meets the target.
Yeah.
So this week has been hellishly hot. I have to say that this past week has been a barn burner. Really, really rough.
It's been
and our crew
upwards of
100 plus, real feel, like 112 in some places. So the people are stressed. The New Yorkers don't like that.
No.
And the plants don't really love that either. But our amazing crew worked through it all. So we just wanted to do a shout out to them.
Yay, gardeners.
They did an amazing job. We usually don't plant in August, but we had a special project that we had to do. So we got her done. Anyway, speaking of getting her done.
That's right.
America. So when you think of America, you think of Washington, D.C., right? That's
right.
The first thing you think of. But you don't immediately think of D.C. in relation to horticulture, right? It's not like...
It's a swamp.
It's a swamp. There are the cherry trees.
Yes.
You know, which is amazing and that an icon of spring. But it's not like the kind of town that's synonymous with gardens like Charleston, right, Ellis, or Savannah, or even Boston. Boston has like...
Right, or San Francisco.
Exactly. Right. So it's our nation capital. Our nation's capital. It's the place of where the business of the nation is supposed to get done.
The business.
And as we will learn on today's show, some of that work includes horticulture, which, in my view, is the very root of our nation's prosperity. I mean, it's what we were founded on. Farming, food.
Agriculture. That's right.
So when Alice and I did our show on presidents and plants in February, which was a really fun show, the U.S. National Arboretum website was a really great resource for us for our research. And I felt that we should do a show on this American institution to highlight the work that they do. I don't think enough people know that it exists.
Right.
And I could be wrong, but I think outside of the immediate horticultural world, I don't think a lot of people go to Washington and say, oh, I must go to the Arboretum. And Alice and I want to do a little bit of our part to help change that.
Well, I have to amend though, because I was a kid in Washington D.C.
Right, you grew
so
up
for
there.
Me, horticulture is born in Washington D.C.
Right,
because that was where I developed my love of plants
exactly
as a kid, and my father worked for the National NEH, National Institute for Humanities. So I had this kind of back door
right
into the Smithsonian.
But you had you had a special...
And into the Arboretum. Yeah. And, yeah.
Exactly. But I think the average person doesn't think,
no,
you know, to go there. They want to go to the Lincoln Memorial. They want to go to the Smithsonian.
Right.
So in this election year, we thought it was even more important. If you're going to go to Washington and protest, maybe you could also go and visit the Arboretum.
Right. And then our last show was on the White House Gardens.
Yes, exactly. So we want it to be a very American...
Washington-centric.
And national, you know, American-centric kind of series. And this is a place for all Americans.
That's right.
You know, it's been a very acrimonious and divisive period in our history, and it's continuing to be. So let's focus on the good.
Yes.
The good that the government is doing, the good that
right.
Horticulture is doing for the nation. So to that end, we have an amazing guest today, Dr. Richard T. Olson, who is the new director of the U.S. National Arboretum. And Alice is going to tell us a little bit about him.
Right. So he's got a very distinguished career as director of the Arboretum. Richard Olson guides the Arboretum in its mission to enhance the economic, environmental, and aesthetic value of ornamental and landscape plants through long-term multidisciplinary research, conservation of genetic resources, and interpretive gardens and displays. Prior to his appointment in 2015, he was a research geneticist and lead scientist in the Arboretum's research unit, where he led the urban tree breeding and germplasm efforts since joining the USDA in 2006. Richard reinvigorated these programs and developed new ornamental breeding projects utilizing modern genetic tools and breeding strategies, unified germplasm and curation efforts, and re-engaged industry stakeholders. He is a recognized international leader in the public garden arena, providing scientific expertise and practical knowledge to multiple national and international arboretae, urban forestry groups, and professional associations. Dr. Olson has a Bachelor's of Science degree in Landscape Design from NC State University, a Master degree in Horticulture from the University of Georgia, and a Doctorate in Horticultural Science, again, from NC State University. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Gosh, I didn't know I was so distinguished.
You are very distinguished. And good old NC State, right?
That's right.
It's produced some of the best...
Best people.
Best people.
So, Dr. Olson, Alice gave us a little taste of how she got interested in gardening and horticulture. We like to ask this of a lot of our guests. What brought you to horticulture as a profession? Was it something that started in childhood or something that came later? Tell us a little bit about yourself and the background.
Yeah, it's always a good question to slow down and think about it, how you got to where you are. And I think for me with horticulture, I certainly have childhood memories. I was born in Wisconsin, and one of my earliest memories was, in terms of plants, was we didn't have trees. We were in the tall grass meadows up there, so our paths to our friend's house or through the neighborhood were through the tall grass prairies and the cattails. And, you know, that's a pretty magical experience.
I think
that's probably why I love ornamental grasses to this day. But I was always in the garden. Their first garden experience was helping my parents plant rhubarb. Of all things, and I never really took to rhubarb. I do now as a little bit of an adult, but I think I have a lot of I was always involved with my parents. I'm one of four siblings, and I was the one that was always there working. I used to say about my brothers were and sisters were that some people are like blisters; they show up after the work is done.
I love it. I'm going to remember that right
after.
So I was always involved in learning from my dad and mom, and so I think I didn't put it together into college actually through a roundabout way, but I was always outdoors. I was in Boy Scouts. I'm an Eagle Scout, so did a lot of hiking and camping in the southern United States when we moved to North Carolina. So was into trees, but didn't know what their names were.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I got into college, everything sort of fell into place.
Wait, but did you get the botany badge? I just want to know, Richard.
I did. I got pretty much everything I could.
Botany, of course.
Biology, nature, reptilian studies.
That's great. I only know that because my husband's an Eagle Scout, and that was really important to him.
Yeah, I got aviation. I got a lot of badges, but no, it was good. You know, I was outside. Everyone did it back then.
Yes,
we were in a small town in North Carolina, and so what happened was when I was in high school, I was really big into soccer, and so I played soccer. I got invited to play soccer in college. And I was also into history and international studies. So I started off, actually, my freshman year at American University in Washington, D.C., studying international relations and playing soccer. And part of that was just being macho. You know, like I had to show everybody, you can leave your small town in North Carolina and go away, go to the big town, and, you know, and not stay local.
Right.
Well, after a year up there, I realized that, well, maybe staying local isn't a weakness. It's a strength. And so I was not happy with international relations, and it was actually my future father-in-law, who put two and two together and said, hey, look, you were always outside in Boy Scouts. You always loved art. I took art whenever I could, and so why don't you do landscape architecture? And I was like, well, I don't even know what landscape architecture is. So I actually transferred to North Carolina State to study landscape design and took my first plant class. And everything clicked because what I also took in high school, I was horrible with languages. There's one reason I had to quit international relations is because you had to speak a foreign language. But I was really good with Latin because, to me, Latin was a puzzle. I took Latin throughout high school. And so when I took my first plant class, it was like, wow, this all makes sense. I already got the Latin background. I've got the plant background. Now I'm just putting it together.
Right. That's great.
That sounds like a natural.
Are you still playing soccer?
I do, when my back allows. My son my oldest son is on the travel team now, so I get to live vicariously through him.
Good. So before becoming the director of the Arboretum, you were the lead scientist in the Arboretum's research unit. Tell us about your work there on trees and your efforts to modernize the labs and engage with the industry.
Yeah, I had the great pleasure or honor of coming straight out of finishing my PhD straight to the National Arboretum. And I always tell everyone I pinched myself when I walked across the bridge into the administration building and the labs for the first time, because I couldn't believe that I was working at this storied institute. And what I was doing was I actually was continuing on and inheriting two projects that were sort of legacy programs at the National Arboretum. One that had to do with breeding Dutch elm disease tolerant American elms and other hybrid elm species,
mm-hmm.
and then also a red maple breeding program. And I also inherited another scientist's projects that he worked on a large number of different tree species, but near the end of his career was not doing much in terms of breeding. So I was sort of brought in to sort of take the reins of those two programs and create one strong breeding program. And so my focus became on, at that time, I'm not sure, you know, red maples, as you know, are pretty ubiquitous and pretty much overplanted in the urban forest. So I wanted to look at stuff that would broaden the diversity of plant material that was in cultivation and take a risk on some of these crops or some of these trees that people maybe, you know, had poo-pooed in the past and hadn't given them another chance. And during my PhD, I worked on catalpa, or the Indian bean trees.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's, yeah. We need, I mean, your work, what Alice and I have seen in New York City with the Million Trees Initiative that right. The former mayor had started and still, I think it's kind of wrapping up now.
Yeah.
But we've seen probably some of the fruits of your labor, because there's much more diversity in urban tree planting here in New York.
Yeah.
There's not just London Plains and pin oaks and red oak. I mean, there's some really interesting.
And ginkgos, right. And,
yeah, they're trying different things, which is great. You know?
Yeah. I think it wouldn't be me, but I think everyone has sort of caught on and realized in the last you know, two decades that, you know what, we have a lot of great material that is available. And of course, my predecessors, I had a lot of great professors down at North Carolina State and University of Georgia that, you know, really preached the need for diversity so that we have more sustainable landscape plantings in urban forests. And so it really has caught on. But so I worked on catalpa, which was a really good example of this is a genus of trees.
I love catalpa. Yeah.
There was about, at the time when we started working, there was about 14 or 15 species in the world. Several of them, quite a few of them were hardy, and they had different flower colors. Some really old cultivars had different foliage characteristics. And so we thought, well, there's a lot of ornamental traits here that we can work with. They also have a number of problems, powdery mildew, catalpa worm, a little bit of hardiness issues. And then there's the fruit. You know, a lot of urban foresters don't like the large leaves or large fruit. But so we thought, well, here's a group of plants that we could work with and slowly over time develop an interesting line of new material. And so it's now 2016. I've been at it more than 10 years. This is I started during my PhD. And I wish I could show you some of the flowering hybrids we have in our fields with novel flower colors, deep purple flower colors or saturated pinks. And so we're hybridizing them with some of their close relatives. And now looking at them for their disease tolerance and hardiness. So, you know, we're gonna recreate what you think of when you think of catalpa.
And we are gonna keep our eyes open for the Olson variety of catalpa. Is that right?
The first one we had some nurserymen. So the other thing I did was I came from a background of really understanding that, you know, we exist to solve problems for American agriculture or American horticultural problems. And in this particular interest, the stakeholders are not just the American people who need trees in their lives, but it's also the nursery industry that grows all these trees. You know, they need something that fits into their production schedules and you can actually sell it, you know. And so we just had a number of tree growers out to our fields earlier this summer, and they saw some of our first hybrids, and we've sent out material. So they now understand what we were talking about, and they're really excited about a couple of our hybrids. And so that would probably, you know, it takes a while, though.
Yes.
Things don't grow overnight. So they probably won't really be on the market for another 3 or 4 years.
Right.
It takes a couple of decades from the point of development to get to market and kind of thinning out and finding the best ones. Mm-hmm. You know, one example that I think came through the USDA and probably the Arboretum was crepe myrtles, right? Didn't the USDA do lots of work on crepe myrtles? And now, many, many years ago, and now we have so many different cultivars.
Hardy ones.
Hardy ones that we can choose from, that we use here in New York, and that do wonderfully.
Yeah, that's probably our greatest success story, and it's a wonderful story that combines the long-term efforts, high-risk efforts that we're supposed to be involved in as Agricultural Research Service scientists, the continual need for plant exploration and collection and distributing novel material to folks. And so, in the 1950s, USDA plant explorers in Japan discovered a new species of crepe myrtle, but they collected this species for the first time. It had tremendous red bark and large tree-like proportions, and appeared to be considerably hardier than what we were used to as the common crepe myrtle. When the plants came back to the United States and they were distributed to places like here, of course, at the National Arboretum and further south, people realized that this species had powdery mildew resistance, which was a huge problem, still is a huge problem for crepe myrtles in the south. And so over the next four decades, our scientist, Dr. Don Egoff, and then his successor, Dr. Margaret Pooler, developed a series of hybrids that incorporated the nice saturated flower colors of the common crepe myrtle with the disease resistance from the Japanese crepe myrtle and also the dwarf crepe myrtles. They were the first to introduce the dwarf genes into the crepe myrtles. So we've introduced about close to 30 crepe myrtles now. And more importantly, it's not just that our crepe myrtles are out there, but if you look at the pedigree of the crepe myrtles that other people are using, they're using our genetics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So most of, you know, probably upwards of 75% of all the crepe myrtles on the market today are either ours or derived from our genetics. And so that's a pretty huge impact.
See, that's what I think a good use of tax dollars is, honestly. Some of these other programs I'm not that interested in. But breeding plants? I love that. So the Arboretum, right? It's relatively new in our nation's history. I mean, England has Kew, of course. They have the Royal Botanic Garden. It goes back to, I think, the 17th century or perhaps earlier. But our National Arboretum was founded in 1927. Can you tell us a little bit about its founding and what its mission was and how that has evolved?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. You're going to regret having me on the radio because I can talk for quite a while. But although we were created by an act of Congress in 1927, we're actually much older than that, because the reason we were enacted in 1927, just to give you a little bit of Washington history here, is. At the turn of the century, people soon realized in Washington, D.C., this is, you know, the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th, was that Washington, D.C. was not developing along the lines that LaFont had envisioned the National Mall. And so the McMillan Commission, which later became the Senate Park Commission and now what we call the National Capital Park Planning Commission, said, we got to get back to what LaFont had envisioned. And so we're going to control, sort of use that word loosely, how the city develops. And so they had to redevelop the mall. Well, we were on the mall. The Department of Agriculture was founded during the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln. And since that time, up until the beginning of the 20th century, we had a huge and dominant presence on the mall. And our gardens were all across the mall. And we had tree collections on the mall and gardens on the mall. So when the McMillan Commission came through, they said, well, we've got to get rid of all of this, because we need to turn it back to a mall. And it just took Congress about two decades to figure out where we needed to go. And so the legacy of horticulture at the National Arboretum dates to the very beginning of the Department of Agriculture. And so we were founded in 1927 on this site here in Northeast Washington, D.C. We're only 2 miles from the Capitol. Unfortunately, 1929 was the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you had the New Deal and the aftermath of the Depression and the New Deal. And then we went straight into World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't really until the 1950s that our government could focus on what it had tried to create. And so really it was after the 1950s even that we started to really develop what we now know of as the National Arboretum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating, because the botanic gardens here in New York, they date from the 19th century, you know,
both
of them.
Yeah.
So it was very fascinating to me when I was doing research for the interview to say, wow, this is something that I thought would have been in existence long before, you know, regional botanic gardens.
Yeah. But I think one of the major differences is that because we were created much later, our whole purpose was to conduct research and education in the tree and plant life. A lot of the early botanical gardens were more of the Victorian model, or even earlier, the Renaissance model of sort of collecting and classifying and sort of showing off this collection of curios.
Yes, a museum of plants, a museum of plants, sort of.
Right, and so a lot of them developed, like the New York Botanic Garden. You know, they had to focus around the world, and so there could be botanists in the tropics or in Africa, you know, collecting, and they would be studying and classifying. And it's incredibly needed research still to this day, and it's very important. But it puts us in a different sort of category in the sense that we weren't just here to display plants and show people, look at these beautiful plants from around the world. Our job was to say, okay, here are the beautiful plants from around the world. What can they do for our industry, and how can we make our American landscapes better? So it's a real difference that really came out in the 1920s, because that was when people were had already rediscovered the laws of genetics and inheritance. Mm-hmm. And so that was the new frontier, was breeding and plant improvement, and that's when we started.
So can I ask you, when the vision for LaFont's original plan occurred, what happened to the original gardens? Were any of those plants saved?
Well, not many. There are some around the monument, Washington Monument. There's a few old ginkgos that originate from our original planting plan. There's a few trees around the USDA building, but there's really not much left. The other There's also the U.S. Botanical Garden, which is at the foot of the Capitol.
Right. I've been there.
Yeah, and that was sort of set up, again, as sort of the more, you know, Victorian model originally.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Novi, Ari Novi, the director there, would kill me if I said that now because they do so much more. But
right.
And it's a wonderful place. But there is some older plantings sort of near them that date to sort of the early plantings involved with the Botanic Garden around that same time or earlier. So there's not much left from the original stuff.
So who laid out the original plan on the mall? Is that anyone of significance?
Well, actually, you put me on the spot. I think the first guy that was involved was Wallace. He was a horticulturist. I may have the name wrong, but one of the first hires. I could look that up in a second. But he was, if I remember right, he was a Scottish gardener that came over and laid out the grounds. He was heavily involved. In fact, actually, his first job was to lay out the cemetery for Gettysburg. And he's pictured behind Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address because, you know, they were very concerned, the USDA, that with how to treat the war dead and where they were going to go, and so they were focused on building appropriate memorials and cemeteries for the war dead. And so,
right.
And you needed plants.
And a Scotsman.
A lot of good Scotsmen. Yeah. We've talked a lot about Scotsmen.
I had his name wrong. I say Wallace, but I can't remember now. But it wasn't Wallace. It was somebody else. I apologize.
Okay, no worries. Okay. Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'm sorry for
that. So, Dr. Olson, tell us, for those who haven't visited the Arboretum, and I include myself in that list, but I'm going to correct that, tell us about the collections and sort of the size and the design of the grounds, because you said basically it was laid out in the 1950s is really when it got going. Tell us about what's there and what people can expect to see.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say the collection started building in the 1950s, but during the 30s, we had actually this Civilian Conservation Corps here. We actually had it segregated. It was one of the few African-American camps because, of course, we were in an urban area. And so they did the initial draining work and laying out the roads, and we laid out a few more roads during World War II. We were actually part of the air defense for the city during World War II.
Wow.
So once we got the military out of the way, we were able to start doing some planting. But it was laid out originally because to take advantage of a car, right? The car was a great invention. So we have about 9.5 miles of roads where you could leisurely drive through the grounds and see the collections. The central core of the Arboretum is dominated by what we call our Ellipse Meadow, which is a giant 20-something acre or more meadow in the middle of Washington, D.C. here, where our Capitol columns sit. If you've never been, we're very famous. We have the original Capitol columns from the Capitol building here. On the grounds, it looks almost like the Parthenon or an Acropolis overlooking the grounds here. And that was thanks to our friends of the National Arboretum, our principal nonprofit, private nonprofit group that helps us. But and so spinning off of that, you have the National Herb Garden. We have the Glendale Azalea Hillside, which is, you know, 10,000-12,000 azaleas that light up the spring, which were really planted after World War II, that really sparked the public to come in on the grounds. Everybody started talking, hey, have you seen all the azaleas on Mount Hamilton?
And that's what we have a bazillion Easter pictures.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Year after year after year of like my entire family in front of those azaleas.
Yes, you and 500,000 other.
Exactly.
People. Yeah.
But it's it's wonderful, and that's one of our early breeding successes too, as well, because we were the first to introduce the large flowered azaleas that were, you see further south, into a cold hardy form that you could grow in this area. So that was a very major breeding breakthrough that happened at the National Arboretum. But we had the National Boxwood Collection, the Grove of State Trees. But one of our strengths too is that we have an incredible collection of our native woodland wildflowers here in Fern Valley, our native plant collection. And then we have their congeners, we call them, or their relatives from Asia. We have an incredible collection of Chinese, Japanese, and Korean plants that have been collected in the wild for the last 50, 60 years.
Do you still send explorers out or send botanists out to collect for the Arboretum, or is that no longer done?
No, we still do it. It's something that's really important to this day. And it's getting a little trickier because of international treaties and other regulations. Mm-hmm. But we are part of the National Plant Germplasm System, which is the system that will safeguard the crops that are important to American agriculture, world agriculture, and their wild crop relatives, because they are a source of the genetics that we may need to solve future pest and disease outbreaks or climate change. So we still collect. In fact, we have one of our young staff members is headed off to Georgia, the country Georgia, which is in the Caucasus. We are looking, we still are trying to organize something to Morocco. This probably won't happen this spring. China, you know, a lot of people still go to China.
Right.
We haven't had scientists there in a while. We're still working on agreements for that plant material. But, people still go around the world. And our good colleagues are actually going to China from the Arnold Arboretum, speaking of one of the oldest arboretum botanical gardens in the country. Founded in the 1870s, I believe, in Boston.
Tremendous.
Probably really the godfather of all of our institutes, because their first director really influenced a lot of people around the country to study and collect plants.
Yeah, we had a woman, Julie Shapiro, on a few years ago. She's the photographer and documenting all of the seeds for the Arnold Arboretum.
Yeah, that's her job.
That's her job.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. She's worked with us, too, a little bit. We have one of the things we also have are a collection of dried plants, which are our herbaria. It's plural for herbarium. So we have, we have the typical pressed and preserved dried plant specimens that you maybe would have made as a kid, of the flowers or the leaves.
Right.
But we also have the National Seed Collection.
Uh-huh.
So we have one of the largest seed collections in the world that are used by scientists, regulators, actually, even criminal investigations use the seed collections.
Wait, we have to take a break, but I want to talk about the criminal element, Dr. Olson. Now you've really gone down
a
totally really different path. We have to take a break just for a minute. Stay on the line, and we're going to talk about seeds
and criminality.
And criminality. We'll be right back on We Dig Plants.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com. From the finger bowl.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Alice and I today are here with the director of the U.S. National Arboretum, Dr. Richard Olson. Doctor, you left us with a little bit of a cliffhanger. Okay.
Yes.
We need to know how the herbaria, this sounds like an Agatha Christie novel, how the herbaria was used in a criminal investigation.
Yeah, well, it is a little bit like CSI, but what has happened before? I have not been here since it's happened, but it has been used in the past. Well, if you have a crime that is conducted in a state like Florida, and then you have a suspect in North Carolina that is associated and maybe has dirt in their car where the crime was conducted, if there are seeds in the dirt. And you're trying to say, well, where did these seeds come from? Could they have come from plants native to this particular area where the crime scene was done? Well, then they would come and they would look at samples and sort of match up and identify the seeds. And so it has been used in
that's fascinating
to put people at crime scenes. Yeah, so Now that's unusual.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
Again, our regulators, we are our sister agency in the USDA, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. They're in charge of, you know, inspecting our ports, inspecting shipments, and there are times where seeds are discovered on either accidentally in shipments that they're not supposed to be in, or they're part of actually trade goods. Beadwork, for instance, is a
right.
really common. And sometimes there are seeds that are either used or accidentally being imported that may be noxious weeds or not allowed, and so
right.
they have to compare with known samples. And so,
well, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we actually had one of the USDA plant inspectors on our show a long, long, long time ago. That was a fascinating topic.
Yeah. He didn't want to answer all of our questions, though, Richard. He was a little tight-lipped about some of the things that they found at Kennedy Airport.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
I know. It's not. We laugh about it, but I mean, the Japanese beetle came in from what I understand, from artificial Christmas trees.
Yeah.
Right.
It came in.
They're looking at. There's a new beetle.
Yeah.
There's a new beetle. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's get back to the arboretum and the herbarium, which really specializes in cultivated plants. Can you explain the reasoning behind why it's important to conserve these plants still?
The plants themselves,
why should we conserve these plant specimens? Right? Why is this still relevant?
Well, because they give us a track. They, even though they're preserved and pressed, they're still providing useful data. And as we come up with new technology and new questions, we can go back and ask questions. It's like going back in time and asking those questions all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, there has been a couple of instances where if we are studying a disease that is affecting one of our commercial crops, and we want to be able to see how it has mutated or changed relative to earlier epidemics of this disease, you sometimes have specimens preserved in a fungal herbarium, but sometimes you have to go back to herbaria and find plants where someone might have pressed a plant with the fungus or the pathogen on it.
Ah, right.
So, wow.
So you can go back to that specimen and, let's say, extract DNA from that plant or from that pathogen, and you can use it to compare with your modern problem to see, give you clues on how to deal with it or how it's changed. Same thing with climate change. We are able to go back to our records now and see when plants were collected, where they were collected, what time of year they were in flower, and we can track and help use those tracks to predict how plant populations will shift with climate change. And for us as cultivated plants, where we may cultivate and grow those plants where they shift, because that would be an important model for all of agriculture to know, well, where should I grow this crop in the future if we're not going to be able to grow it here?
Right. Holy cow. So,
and cultivated plants, you're not just, you know, specifically focused on that, which is very practical, you know, and very...
Right, and it goes back to our mission. It's not, you know, all plants and animals and biodiversity in general is very crucial for the planet for a number of reasons. But at the end of the day, being as with the USDA and we're tasked with solving the problems of American agriculture, and I use that because horticulture and the nursery industry is all lumped under agriculture.
Yes.
That we have a very practical side of it that says, you know, these plants are useful to man. They're going to help sustain us into the future. And so somebody has to focus on what's cultivated. And, you know, our partners in other botanical gardens and other arboreta focus on stuff from around the world or wild collected material.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all fit in into this big puzzle and fill a very important niche. But we think at the end of the day, it's pretty noble what we do in terms of trying to safeguard these plants for use by society.
Are your holdings open to the public, like online? I know some botanical gardens have joined this world organization that actually started at Kew, so that you can go onto the database and look up. Are you connected in with that?
We have been in the past. I know there's been some technical blips in terms of accessing. But our if it's not currently linked, it's not our intention not to be linked. But there are some technical issues. But our database is accessible, and we can a lot of it is through the USDA's GRIN network, the Germplasm Resource Information Network. So if somebody typed up USDA and GRIN, G-R-I-N, you could do a search of, for instance, your favorite species of oak tree, and you would, if we had it, it would come up, and then there'd be a link for you to get more information and to request the material. Now, of course, that's for our scientists, colleagues, and peers at other institutes, not typically for the general public. So I don't want all your readers to try to find free plants. But, but it is, you can view that, and of course you can work with our staff to get access. And we're doing more and more to try to make that as readily as available as possible. We actually have, I haven't told a lot of people yet, but we have an app that we're hoping to release pretty soon, which will give people on their phones as they're on the grounds instant access to our database and our plant locations and mapping. So they'll be able to engage with our collection throughout the grounds with their mobile devices. So that's going to be really cool.
It's Pokemon. It's the new Pokemon.
Yes, that reminds me. Well, were there any Pokemon on the grounds?
Yeah.
we have a gym, I would say. So any of your Pokemon Go people, I've been told we have a gym that's very valuable. And so come to our gym. Yes.
So do you have gym. Do you have citrus too at the Arboretum?
Yeah, we have a couple, but again, we're not that far north. We don't grow many. What we grow is what we call the hardy orange, which is typically used as a rootstock in the citrus breeding citrus program.
Uh-huh.
Yes. It's pretty cool to be able to say you have a citrus. It's a thorny beast with really cool orange, little oranges. But it's so full of seed and so sour, and pretty much maybe you can use it for a cocktail or marmalade, but that's about it.
Okay. So tell us what you have a strategic plan and a master plan. So tell us what's the future for the USNA?
Well, the future is sustainability, really. The National Arboretum Strategic Plan was about how we can take advantage of our relationships and specific authorities to engage our friends groups and others to really help shore up our bottom line. You know, things have been tight in the federal government for a long time with flat budgets, and so we have special authorities, and we have these friends groups, and so we're trying to engage more with them to help elevate and create awareness of the National Arboretum and to shore up our funding. So and part of that is we're going to be relooking at our relevance. Every institute, you know, needs to say, where do we fit nowadays? And I say that in a very important way, and I've tried to explain this to our scientists. Our strength historically has been in ornamental plant breeding at the National Arboretum. We have, since 1927, have introduced more than 650 different types of ornamental plants. And we were doing it long before anyone else was doing it. And nowadays, I don't know if you've been to a garden center lately, but I'm sure you have, if you're sitting at one right now. But new plants are the norm, right?
You
see new plants everywhere. The industry gets new plants. So we have to ask ourselves, well, if everyone is breeding new plants, what plants are we going to breed? What are the big challenges that we as federal scientists can tackle that our partners at land-grant universities or our partners in industry can't do? And usually that's the long-term high-risk project.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's the one, like the crepe myrtles, that takes 4 decades before you have a payout. Because obviously industry can't wait 4 decades to have a payout. I'm going to be asking them. We're going to be going through a review this year with the industry to say, where is it that you see us? Where is it that the synergy can be had? And how do we move forward? So that's a big deal, because we do have some legacy programs here, and we've got to figure out where everything fits. And so we're about to hire 2 more scientists, one to replace me, actually, to replace the positions I vacated when I took over as director. So that's really exciting to know that we're committed towards plant breeding. We're committed towards plant genetic resources.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to look at our master plan again. Our master plan is about 20 years old now, and we haven't really been following it.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really, so we've got to re-engage with and have a real master plan that we can follow for the next 100 years. It's going to take help from the outside to get that funding. And on top of that, we've got other projects that are moving along that are helping with our capital infrastructure. We're trying to wrap up a $2.5 million renovation of the Japanese Bonsai Pavilion.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. I can see it from outside my window. I wish that the American public could get in there and see it, but we're not quite done yet. So that's going to house the original gift of bonsai from the people of Japan from 1976, the 53 bonsai, in a world-class setting.
Mm-hmm.
That's really reflective of their how unique and special they are. And we're also, we've got some infrastructure projects. We're doing spring restorations on the grounds. We're trying to look at our carbon footprint and saying, how can we improve and really, you know, put our money, not, you know, when you're a botanical garden nowadays in the 21st century, if you're not first and foremost doing something for the environment and ecology, you know, you're really falling behind, and,
yeah.
and we need to be a leader in that field. So we're taking a look at that, doing spring restorations, streamhouse restorations. And the big thing that's coming around the corner, we're still, is the National China Garden.
I was going to ask you about that, if that is happening,
yeah.
if that's...
We're moving closer. It's been in the works for a long time. We've had a series of meetings here recently. We're still trying to hammer out a few things. But, yeah, it could be, you know, we could be starting on that within a year. So that's a $60 million project. That's a gift from the people of China to the people of the United States through the USDA. We've got partners in the State Department working on this as well, and the Foreign Ag Service and the Chinese Embassy. So the National China Garden Foundation was created as a nonprofit to pull this off. And so that's going to be a real game changer. It's a 12-acre garden with 22 buildings. It's a classical Chinese garden in the style of Yangzhou Gardens in southeast China.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting.
That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. Well, we don't have a lot of time, unfortunately, but I did want to ask you about the Eagles, okay, because I have to.
Yeah.
So tell us about that got a lot of attention from the public. Two eagle chicks were born, right, on the grounds.
Yep.
And was there always a nest there, or is this like a new thing, Dr. Olson?
It's a new thing.
Okay.
Freedom and Liberty were the eagles that were born this year. This was the second hatch of eagles. We actually had the first was the year before. That was the first time that eagles returned to the National Arboretum since 1947, actually. The road that our azaleas are on is actually called Eagle Nest Road because that's where the last eagle nest was. So they returned after about a 70-year absence.
That's amazing.
And so we bordered the Anacostia River, so I think it speaks to the fact that the environment is changing, improving for the better, and that you know the populations of eagles coming out of the Chesapeake Bay have been flourishing, and they've been searching for more and more grounds to nest, and so they found a 105-foot tall tulip poplar in our collection as a perfect spot, and so. They were here last year, but we didn't. By the time we knew they were here, we couldn't do anything about putting up eagle cams. And so when they left last summer, we went ahead and got up there, put in the cameras, got the system, and we were ready for them this fall. And I'm glad we were. We had more than 60 million viewers.
The photos are amazing.
Yeah.
I posted this morning, or yesterday actually, of the two parents looking down on the eagle chicks. And it's just really, really gratifying to see that.
Our partners, the American Eagle Foundation, they put up some really nice, expensive cameras. So an internet service, essentially.
First things first, right?
Well, that generation of eagles is going to be completely savvy with
millennials. Those are millennial eagles.
Yes, they are.
So we are looking at it now. You know, the nest needs a little work. It's in a precarious position. Mm. We're working with some partners to try to figure out what we can do to help them out, and with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and so all things. look towards another great season for the Eagles to come back.
Have they fledged? I mean, are they out of?
Oh yeah, they fledged. They fledged in. They finally left around. I think we turned off the cameras sometime around Independence Day, July 4th, I believe, somewhere around there.
Okay.
But they were like, you know, they were like any teenager. They were kind of hanging around for a lot longer than they probably should.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
So I have one final question, Dr. Olson. It's summer. People are still planning their vacations or possibly coming down to D.C. And I think of D.C. as a great place for families to come. Anybody, all of my family from Italy, from other places in the U.S., they ask me where to go. I'm like, go to D.C.
You have to go to D.C.
It's a great place. So tell us a little bit about what's happening there for the public this summer and into the fall that people should know about.
Well, we are... Our crepe myrtles are essentially in full bloom now. They love the heat. So right as everybody begins to wilt in Washington, D.C., the crepe myrtles are at their peak. So there's always something to see here at the Arboretum. We have, unfortunately, we've had a lot of retirements in our education department. So we have some of our programs are on hold for a little bit, but we're about to announce the return of our famous full moon hikes, which are consistently voted as one of the top date things to do. Things to do with a date in Washington, D.C. Basically, we open the grounds on to guided tours during the full moon, so you get access to the grounds in the evening. And so those are always popular. And then we're going to finish up this summer with our fall festival, which will be the first time in many years that we've done this. It's the Akimatsuri Festival, which is celebrating our connection with Japan and East Asia, and will culminate with a moon viewing ceremony with the Japanese American Society. So that takes us into the fall.
That's great. That does sound like a really great date.
I did forget, though, with our friends group, we have added music to the gardens, which has been a first. And so we'll have a couple more jazz nights in the gardens, which have been real popular.
Yeah.
And have been free and open to the public, which is amazing.
Good. Good. Well, thank you so much for all the work that you do and for joining us today and sharing with us some history and future initiatives for the National Arboretum. It really did influence me as a child, and it really is an amazing special place.
So well, thank you. It's been my pleasure to been on the show with you, Carmen and Alice. It's been wonderful. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah.
Thanks. And we'll post links to the Arboretum's website and stuff on our Facebook and social media. Thank you for listening to We Dig Plants. The show is written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, or on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Or you can follow us and all of our shenanigans on roofs and backyards at groundworksgardens.com. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.